Blog Talk Radio.
This land is mine. God gave this land to me. This brave and ancient land to me. And when the morning sun reveals her hills and plains, then I see a land where children can run free. So take my hand and walk this land with me, and walk this lovely land with me. When you are by my side, with the help of God, I know I can be strong.
Well, good evening and welcome to Yada Ya Radio. I'm here with Kirk. Always a pleasure to join you on a Shabbat evening. How are you, my friend?
Yes, indeed. Me too. With you. And you.
Yeah, we ended last week sharing just one of the treasures in Bereshit in the beginning. This was from the 22nd chapter. Our next meeting with Abraham and Yahweh will be in the 26th chapter, at least as it relates to the covenant. And just to reprise what we shared, I'll read that passage, and we can talk a little more about it before we go on to the 17th. I think it was your conclusion. Go ahead, Kirk.
No, it's bears repeating the like the uses of the how he changed from I said or he said, and then what he used Nuam, and then Amar and Quora. I mean, he's a great communicator.
A great communicator. Doesn't miss a trick. And doesn't miss an opportunity. You know, doesn't miss a trick is a human phrase. Shouldn't be applied to Yahweh. Doesn't mean it miss an opportunity to lay out a treasure, a pearl, for those willing to search for it. And that's really the fun of translating. It's filled with pearls and diamonds and rubies and sapphires for us to find that we're purposely placed there for us to build the ultimate treasure. I was going to say that it was my conclusion earlier that your favorite chapter was the 10th chapter, because it systematically lays out the five terms and conditions of the covenant and the five benefits of the covenant as they are presented by Yahweh to Abraham. Mm-hmm. And so we'd be hard-pressed to find anything more important than that. And, you know, I'll acquiesce that that's really good stuff. It may be my favorite chapter in the book. But I am personally, excited about, kind of uplifted by, reinforced, encouraged by what is now contained in this chapter, which is the 11th chapter of the first volume of Yada Ya. I shouldn't have observations for a time. And the reason for it is that, for all of my foibles, and I have more than my share, there are a couple of things that I'm pretty good at. And I think as was the case with Moshe, and as was the case really with Abraham, and certainly the case with Dod, if we have a proclivity that we're willing to devote to Yahweh, it doesn't matter what our weaknesses may be in other areas. Yahweh is in a position to capitalize on what we bring to the table, so long as we are willing to apply the attributes that we may have in life. And we all have them. they're just different among people, and we all have our weaknesses, and, you know, I've got more than my share. But as an attribute, evidence and reason, and being able to understand and make connections and to distill insights and convey them, well, that's my strength.
Yeah, I would say that without a doubt.
I'm uniquely gifted among men with that skill set. Now, that doesn't make me special in any way, shape, or form, you know, because as we've said, I know that I've got more than my share of weaknesses. But that's something that is near and dear to me. It's the one thing that I think I bring to the table, you know, besides the things we all bring to the table. We're all willing to walk away from lies and liars, from religion and politics, no matter the personal consequence. We're all willing to go where God's words lead. We're all willing to accept Him, respect Him. You know, we are always willing to trust and rely on what He has to say.
Right.
And we're passionate about learning what He has to say. We all bring that to the table. That is common with all of us, which is why eternity is going to be so wonderful. But the thing that was kind of unique about my approach to Yahweh's testimony is that steadfastly was committed to this idea that evidence and reason matter.
Mm-hmm.
And that if something is in conflict with what God has said, it can't be true. And that everything God says has to tie together and paint the same overall portrait. And that God has specifically, deliberately made it challenging for us to know Him, for us to accept Him, for us to engage in a relationship with Him, for us to figure this out. It was by design. And it's brilliant, because not only do we get a sense of satisfaction for having figured it out,
mm-hmm.
for having found the treasure, for having invested the effort, not only are we rewarded enormously for having done so, it's the ultimate filter. It keeps the religious and political riff-raff out of heaven. And, you know, Kirk, it really is amazing. And, you know, Kirk, I've been chided for a long time that I suffer fools poorly. I'm not good with stupidity.
Well,
I don't like hypocrisy, and I don't like stupidity. And so for there to have been a test of what Yahweh has conveyed, to participate in the covenant plays right into the heart of what I know, what I care about, what I'm passionate about, and the only thing I may be really good at. So for me personally, this is the core, the very foundation, the validation of everything I've come to know about Yahweh. That the only path to Him is through our minds. We have to observe with our eyes, listen with our ears, think with our minds. We have to be open and receptive to what He has to say. We have to be willing to go where the words lead. And we absolutely must consider all of this rationally and then respond appropriately. That is what this test has been all about from the very beginning.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a radical departure from religion or anything else that you usually run across in life. Nobody asks you to do that. It's hard. I'm beginning to realize how hard it is, only in the sense that the more you translate a little bit here and there, and then you compare with how much stuff they've heaped on the same passages. I mean, throughout this stuff, as we move further along, I've discovered a bunch of stuff when you say, now, wait a minute. You're translating it that way, which makes perfect sense to me. I understand exactly how you're getting there, and I'm looking at these words and saying, okay, that's fair. That's a good connecting of the dots. And then I'll go back and I'll read maybe something in a modern translation, English translation, and go, man, they missed the boat completely.
They missed the boat. Yeah, they missed the boat. And that is the thing that I have become convinced that we have all collectively brought to the table.
Mm-hmm.
That we're all not only witnessing the boat, we're all in the boat.
Yeah.
Every one of us. Doesn't matter who sends me an email. Every one of us is in the boat. Every one of us is growing and finding insights and developing a personal relationship with Yahweh through His Word. We're all finding the same thing. It's all being reinforced. We're all adding to the body of knowledge. And it's all because we were willing to invest the time, we had an open mind, and we're willing to trust what God had to say.
Yeah.
So this stuff really resonates with me. I'm very excited about it. And I love talking about it and sharing it. It has done for me and will do for the listener and reader the very same thing. Able you to know exactly who Yahweh is, how He wants to be known, how He wants to relate to us, what role He wishes to play in our lives, and what we must know and accept and act upon to participate in that relationship. Now, I would ask you, Kirk.
Yeah.
What's more important than that?
Nothing in my life.
If I were to offer you the presidency of the United States, would you trade it? What if I were to offer you the wealth of Bezos and Buffett and the Microsoft fortune all combined?
It doesn't have any value to me. I mean, you can buy a bigger house, so what? I can buy a bigger house.
So what? I got a big house. I'm trying to sell it. Would you like it? I'll cut you a heck of a deal.
Yeah. You know, be nice to have a chauffeur. But, I mean, other than that, there's nothing
I would hate to have a chauffeur. I'd much rather
really?
Drive. So long as the cops would give up the radar gun, so I wouldn't get go a little too fast. But no, I love to drive. I love to fly. I love to boat. I love toys that give us ability and access to enjoy this marvelous world. And life is wonderful. But no, I can't imagine there isn't anything the world collectively could offer that I would trade for the knowledge that we have come to possess.
No, nor I know anyone that I know in the family. I'm beginning to feel, and it could be because of my age, but I'm beginning to feel how short this life is and how much more Yahweh offers than this life. Even if you were to get it and I was in much, much better health, it wouldn't make any difference where when I was younger, you want to succeed and you want to do this and you want to build your business and get good at your art and all that sort of stuff. But the opportunity, this is, I can't tell you that I understand eternity and dimensions and everything other than minor little concepts, but the opportunity to live forever with the master architect, with the greatest teacher ever, greatest creator ever, and travel about as light and be unrestricted by time, have all the energy in the world. My gosh, that's the offer.
Yeah.
And to be
loved. Your perspective as an artist is really helpful here because, first of all, you appreciate light, colors and dimension and perspective. Light provides.
You have to understand what light does on a piece of matter in order to paint well. When you grasp that, then it's easy. When you understand it, then it's easy to make your hand actually do it. And you go, oh, wow, I can render that.
Yeah. So that's helpful. But also, as an artist, you're in a unique position to appreciate the ultimate artist.
Oh, yes. I think so.
Yeah. I'm not an artist, although I appreciate art. But I'm a thoughtful individual, and as a thoughtful individual, you know, I have the joy of being able to know the greatest thinker of all time. And I get to know the thinker's favorite son, who was the greatest thinker among men. That's pretty good.
You ain't kidding.
No. Yeah. And to find out, and this is really what's cool to me, to find out that the greatest thinker among men was as flawed as I am.
Yeah,
but loved him all the more. And how more relaxing could you get in a relationship? How could it get any better than that?
Yeah. Good point.
Yes, that's why so much of this is so encouraging, so wonderful. So, the spiritual messenger, the divine implement, and heavenly representative. Now, this is Wamalak. We can learn a lot by this, Kirk, and we were here last week. One thing I didn't share, one of the things I shared was, of course, that Yahweh, as a seven-dimensional construct, a seven-dimensional being, cannot enter six dimensions, much less three and a half. It's impossible. Absolutely impossible. You know, God can do all things. No, he can't.
Yeah,
there's a lot of things he can't do, and that's one of them. It's impossible. So, how does God reveal himself to his creation? Of course, the first and foremost way, through his words, particularly in a language that exists throughout time, that isn't constrained by time. A relational language with its stems, a volitional language with its moods, timeless language with its conjugations. Well, that's one way he can do it. Another way he can do it is through the set-apart spirit.
Right.
This feminine manifestation of his nature. Can enlighten us and enrich us and empower us, comfort us, protect us. And he can do it through the Malach, spiritual implements, who can also protect us, who can serve as Yahweh's envoys. Implements, very much like you would use a paintbrush. They're an implement. But Yahweh is spirit. And so, by suggesting here, not suggesting, in fact, flat out saying here, that the spiritual messenger, the Malach, was the one who Kara called out to Abraham, and then identifying himself by speaking in first person, Yahweh is saying that he, in fact, is this Malach.
Mm-hmm.
That means that the Malach are, in fact, extensions of Yahweh's nature.
Yes.
They're not just these, you know, if you pick up a paintbrush and that's an implement you're using, the implement is not an extension of your nature, but an extension of your will. It will do as you guide it.
I will it, yeah.
Right. But in this case, Yahweh was the Malach. That doesn't mean all of Yahweh fit into this Malach, but it means that to the extent this Malach was speaking to Abraham, that Malach was Yahweh. Which means that the Malach are far more than just independent implements. They're aspects of Yahweh's very nature. They're extensions of Yahweh's nature. That's a very powerful realization. So when in the 91st Psalm, for example, that the one that transformed my life, the one when Yahweh first spoke to me when I didn't even know who he was, and I said, you know, I'll do this, but only on these three conditions. And he says, okay, just for fun, reach in your pocket and read what's there. And I'm reading about these Malach. They're going to provide this protection. There you go. They're an extension of God himself. That's what this is indicating here. That's really, really humbling. That's really inspiring.
Yeah.
Now, for those that say, wait a minute, we got, you know, a third of the Moloch left and went off to do their own thing in rebellion. How can those Moloch be an extension of Yahweh?
They're unusable, no?
Didn't Yahweh say that he created good and evil? Didn't he say that he was the creator of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil?
Yeah.
So, for Yahweh to be complete, he has to be the embodiment of all of these things. The one who conceived all of these things. And he had to conceive that which is not good if we were to have the opportunity to choose what is good. And if he created it, it was part of his nature, something that he knew.
Well, just to be knowledgeable, he would have to know every side of every facet of the diamond. Well, he's not going to embrace it. He doesn't embrace the evil side, but he has to know it, and you can't have free will if there isn't an alternative.
Yeah. Do you have a mean?
You can't have love if there's no free will, so it's all hand in hand, don't you think?
Yeah. Do you have a mean streak?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Have you ever done anything that you wish you hadn't done?
Thoughts.
Okay. Are you overall a good guy who's got a great relationship with Yahweh?
Oh, yeah. Well, I don't know about the good guy, but I got a great relationship with him because he doesn't see
it. Yeah, he seemed like a real good
guy. He's kind enough not to look at the other stuff.
Yeah. We.
Yes, I do have a great relationship with him.
Yeah, right. Dode, great relationship with Yahweh. Said and did a lot of magnificent. But, you know, he did some stupid stuff too, right?
He did a lot of stupid stuff, yeah.
Right, so.
He's the first one to say so.
With the fallen Moloch, we see in Yahweh aspects of ourselves. God did create us in his image, after all, didn't he?
Yeah, well, we are rebellious until we turn.
Wouldn't eternity be a little boring if everything was always good all the time? You play golf.
Yes, indeed.
If every round was a 59, what would the fun of it be?
I'll tell you a story.
If every shot was a hole in one, why would you play?
You wouldn't.
Occasionally, you have to be like Ian Poulter. I don't know if you saw him play the four par where he had a second shot in the water. The third shot, he bladed it over the green. The third shot, he stumped into the rough side of the green like he was. I could have done better. And the next shot, he still stuffed short of the green. I mean, he's a really good golfer. And yet, boy, did he hack it all over the place. Yahweh made it such that life could be full. And to be full, there really has to be the knowledge of good and evil. And gives us the opportunity to choose that which is good, to cherish that which is good, to study that which is good, and to appreciate that which is bad. So, this, in a way, is providing us just a yet another window to improve, enhance our overall perspective of who Yahweh is, and not to project, to avoid the religious pretentiousness that projects this Pollyanna view towards God, that he's all-loving and all-knowing and all-perfect. No, he's not. He's not. He wouldn't be any fun if he was. We would never get along with him if he was. Okay, I understand how great Yahweh is. I understand how brilliant Yahweh is. I understand how good Yahweh is. I understand how much he has done for us. I get all that. But we ought not plaster him with this notion of perfection in the sense of, you know, everything is blue skies and sunshine. He wouldn't really be someone you'd want to spend eternity with You know, have you ever, I don't know if in your life, I have on occasion, bumped into people that just seemed perfect. I mean, they were either beautiful or handsome. They were gregarious and articulate. They were brilliant and successful. I mean, everything they touched worked. I mean, everything they said was right. And you just go, oh, good grief. This is so depressing. And to a lesser degree, if Yahweh doesn't have a little sense of sarcasm occasionally, you know, humor is very often based upon a little bit of pain. To be really good humor, you got to poke fun at something.
Sarcasm. When you fall down from the battlefield, we laugh.
Yeah, exactly. You know, sarcasm, which is my favorite form of humor because I think it's intelligent humor. You know, it requires some teasing. Teasing is fun, you know?
Yeah.
I really expect God to be, I've used this term, a man's man. You know, just real, credible, approachable, likable. And not, you know, this perfect image sitting on top of his throne that is so awe-inspiring that we dare not approach and most certainly couldn't approach with a smile. You know, if he is that imposing and there isn't anything to him that would cause us to say, you know, this guy, he's really fun.
Mm-hmm.
How would we walk up and give him a big hug and feel comfortable doing so? How could a God that wants to be above it all get down on his knees to lift us up as a loving God?
He's quite earthy, if I can use that term.
Yeah. So
he's
that's what
gets hands dirty.
Okay, so now, in all fairness, I have a tendency to, at times, extrapolate too much out of something. And is there the possibility that I'm reading too much out of Yahweh identifying himself as this Moloch here? Possibly.
You know why?
Well,
you do that because the more you learn, it's like I've noticed lately as I look to look up words, or I'm translating a little passage or something, I know exactly what they're saying. I know what I'm reading there. And then all of a sudden, what will come flooding in is all these other things that I know about that associate with that. And by the time you write all your notes, you say, well, boy, that's a lot, you know, and a lot that's really not, it's there, but that's a lot more I've just written down. And I can prove that that should be there because this is related to that, related to that, related to that. It's like all of a sudden something about a heel and you get Jacob in there and a heel catcher in and he's plants his feet and upright.
Mm-hmm.
After a while, you cannot translate or write these things without getting all that stuff. You know, once you open your mind, like you said last week, and you said now you feel more inclined to write everything down that's in those lexicons about what that word means, you can't edit it.
No, you can't.
I mean, you can edit in context.
But
you can't. All of those things are in that particular word, and if you look, it's a lot more than we put in it. So I don't find it objectionable that when you extrapolate that from that, because you know so much about him now, it's hard not to say, well, that applies and that applies and that applies. And,
We are naturally prone to amplify and extrapolate the more we come to know Yahweh. It becomes central to our nature and our thought process. And it becomes essential to who we are to share what we are learning. But it also is essential to our nature to say, listen, based upon what I know, based upon what this says, if I apply everything I know about Yahweh and that I've learned thus far to this statement, this is what I think could also be important for us to think about.
Mm-hmm.
But, please, if you have a different conclusion, if you think that I've missed something, by all means, challenge it. By all means, form your own conclusion. You know, I think it comes with a sense of humility that says, you know, not everything we perceive precisely accurate. But even if we are extrapolating too far sometimes, it still stimulates our thinking and our growth.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what?
Well, I mean, you know how to sort it out later. You can say, no, that's right. On further thought, that's probably not accurate. The other parts are, you know, something like that. Sure.
But you know what I find is that 99% of the time,
mm-hmm.
on further thought,
it
the
is.
Thought process is reinforced.
Yeah.
That there's something Yahweh says later, he said earlier, but that we read later, that says, yeah, I meant what I said. You were correct in that interpretation, and here is proof.
Yeah.
And you'll just lay it out in the line and say, yep, that's exactly what I meant to say. Good for you for figuring it out. And he'll say it so bluntly, you say, oh, your first response will be, okay, I thought I was so smart to have figured this out. And there you went and just laid it out. And then I say, then the second thought is, I don't even think I would have made the connection if I hadn't come up with the extrapolation first and then seen it reinforced.
Yeah. I found that today in 26.3 and 26.4.
Mm-hmm.
I'd have to go to it to show you what I mean, but and I don't want to jump ahead. But no, you do. You find that. Then I said, well, I wonder if he's thinking about this, that, and the other. And then you get to 23.4 and you say, oh, yeah, that's exactly, duh.
Exactly what he meant. You know, it's like in this particular passage, I began when we opened this chapter and the test began by sharing with everyone, it's my conclusion, and you're free to have a different one if you want, that the Malach, this spiritual implement and representative that is talking to Abraham, is in fact Yahweh. And I think Yahweh will make that point clear as we move along. Well, guess what?
It's clear.
So, you know, it's
very clear.
It's once you have the proper foundation in Yahweh's word, and you come to know him and respect him and accept him as he is, and what he wants and what he's offering, expecting in return, it just all fits together. It's a extremely simple picture presented in the most complex and mesmerizing, beautiful, yes, words. So, the spiritual messenger, the divine implement and heavenly representative, Kara, called out. That's where we spent so much time last week. He didn't say Amar. He will say Amar later, so you know the word is there, but he didn't use the word Amar. He didn't use the word Dabar, which are the, you know, between Amar and Dabar, in this particular context, they would have been used 99% of the time. Use Kara. Because what is he trying to direct our attention to? The Mick Kara.
The Mick, of course.
Yeah. Based on the verb Kara. He called out, summoned and invited, met with and welcomed, proclaimed and designated by name, announcing to, and this is to as L, for the benefit of and as the Almighty to, Abraham, the father who raises up and lifts up. A second time from, and Shamaim can be the sky above, and it can be from the heavens. So, literally, it is possible that this Malach is nothing more and nothing less than the voice of Yahweh.
And communicating voice.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Could Yahweh's voice be encapsulated in light? And so that is the combination of those things? Yeah, absolutely. And what would the difference be between an illuminated voice of Yahweh and a Malach?
Nothing.
Aren't Malach comprised of light?
Yeah.
Don't Yahweh is, the Malach is, Malach means messenger in Hebrew. Yeah. So aren't the Malach Yahweh's illuminated voice?
Yes, sir.
So, there you go. Now you know what this Malach looked like and sounded like. Wouldn't you love to hear Yahweh's voice? I mean, I hear it all the time as I read these words, but the tenor of it. And I've heard it inside of me, resonate within me, you know, but still, I just think that listening to it, you know, in the material world where sound waves and ears and all reverberate outside as well as inside, that would be neat. So the spiritual messenger called out Kara as the Almighty to Abraham a second time from above. And he says, by myself. Now, can I stop here and just say, why a second time? Do you ever just stop for a moment and think, why do you say a second time? Besides the fact this is the second time in the in this particular encounter. What is Yahweh enacting for our understanding on Mount Moriah with Abraham and Yitzhak at this time?
Well, when Yahushua comes.
To fulfill what?
Fulfill Passover, Pesach.
Oh, there you go. What comes next? What second?
Matzah, the most important day.
There you go. So he called out a second time. I have just demonstrated for you Pesach. So now I want to call out a second time. The second Mikra. Matzah. Why? Because Pesach without matzah is counterproductive.
It's worse than that.
Pesach plus the second day, matzah. Ah, that's what leads to Bukurim, to being adopted into Yahweh's family. He called out to him for a second time. Yahweh didn't say a second time for no reason, and it didn't follow Mikra for no reason, or Kara for no reason. These are the pearls that are being laid out for us. From the heavens and said, Amar. Now, why do you think that he switched from Kara to Amar here?
Because he's changing the focus now.
Well, yeah, it might be, but I think it's another reason. And I think it's the reason why there are so many passages that I've translated that have like three different words for man. That because there are three different Hebrew words, you're a derelict to translate all three of them out without seeking to distinguish one from the other. Well, this is the second Mikra. That's why Kara. And now Yahweh chose Amar to tell us, hey, I chose Kara for a reason. Don't say said and said. That's lame. Think of why I would have chosen two different words as opposed to repeated the second, the same word. That's why.
Well, obviously he's talking to him now in person, where the other was a significance because he was calling out to meet and recite or referencing to. So, so now he's talking with him as if he, well, if you're at the meeting.
Yes.
You know, you wouldn't say car, car, car all the time either.
Yeah, you call, you invite somebody into a meeting, and then you...
Let's sit down and talk. Let's sit down and have a conversation.
Right. That's a very nice transition between the two. Yep. So at the second Mikra, you want to sit down and talk? And said, by myself. Now, why would you have to say by myself? There's a reason he said by myself. It's ba-ani. That means... by myself, with myself. That's what it means.
Yeah.
You can try to ignore it if you don't like the idea of Yahweh being our Father, our Savior, our intercessor, our God.
Our one.
Yeah, the one. If you got to have your Jebus, then, you know, I understand why you'd have to write that out. But in Hebrew, that's what it says. By myself. Think of how profound that is. That means that the work that was done on Pesach was Yahweh himself fulfilling that, which makes Yahusha a diminished manifestation of Yahweh, not the second person of a Trinity. The very basis of Christianity is destroyed with by myself. That means that Yahusha isn't our Savior. Yahweh is. By myself. That's just stunningly important.
That's profound.
Oh. One little phrase, Ba'ani, and you've destroyed the lie of Christianity. You've destroyed the lie of Rabbinic Judaism, where you can't figure out what you can't have a chance of understanding what Yahweh actually said just by reading his words and what he had to say and to do for us. You got to have these sages and rabbis intervene and explain it to you. Now, by myself, but it also says there ain't nothing we can do to contribute to the benefits offered by Yahweh fulfilling Pesach and Matzah.
Right.
He's not asking
following
to participate.
No.
Him.
It's not you.
He's doing
it.
You, there's
no
us. There ain't no us in Pesach and Matzah.
No.
He did this by himself for us. By myself. Every word is important. And you discount the opportunity to know Yahweh and to engage in the covenant if you neglect any word. I have made a promise and I have sworn an oath. So when Yahusha, when he climbed up that hill and delivered what's known as the Sermon on the Mount, which would be the instruction on the hill. And he says, do not think for a moment that I have come to annul or do away with anything in the Torah and prophets. I have come to fulfill them. How in the world don't you make this connection? It's a promise that is fulfilled. Who made the promise?
Yahweh.
Who fulfilled it?
Yahweh.
There is no New Testament. There is no New Covenant. There's no role for... Right. There's nothing here other than a promise made, a promise kept. A promise made, a promise kept. Yahweh made the promise. He fulfilled his promise. Where is his promise? Can you find his promise in the book of Matthew, Mark, Luke, John? Can you find his promise in any of the drivel written by Paul?
No.
Where is his promise?
Always in the Torah.
And in this particular case, what promise is he talking about? We're only on the 22nd chapter, using our nomenclature, of the first book of five books of the Torah. We haven't even gotten out of the first book of the Torah, and he says, I made a promise. Where's the promise?
Well, you know, I focused on the Shabbat, the sworn oath. And if you look up Shabbat's history, early history to nomadic people, they viewed a oath, a Shabbat, as something that's repeated seven times, you know, to be emphatic. And they also would look at it as they might do something seven times to reemphasize their sincerity or show their sincerity about the promise that they made. So I was thinking on that this week. And Yahweh has had the Sabbath every week as a reminder. He has 7,000 years with this sukkah at the end. He has seven moed mikros and on.
Yeah, can I answer my question with your answer?
Sure.
I asked, where was that promise made?
Was it made in the
Torah? He says, I have made a promise. Where was that promise made? Since we're now in the 22nd chapter of the first book, Bereshit, of the Torah, that promise had to be made to Abraham.
Yes, indeed. Yes.
That had to be made to Abraham. And it has to be part of what Yahweh personally conveyed to Abraham and had Moshe record for our benefit, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
How many times did Yahweh meet with Abraham?
Seven times.
I answered your question. My question with your answer. There's something else that is profoundly important with this. And that is that Yahweh's promise, the promise that is the most meaningful for us, to know who God is, what he's offering, what he's willing to do for us, is found in its entirety in the Torah. And it is conveyed in the dialogue Yahweh had with Abraham. You don't need no stinking New Testament. You don't need it. Most of it's untrue.
Or a rabbi.
You don't need a priest. You don't need a rabbi. You most certainly don't need a religion.
No.
You need to read, think about, study what Yahweh said to Abraham. The promise he made is the promise of the covenant to Abraham. He told Abraham, if you do these things, if you act upon them, I will provide these benefits. And he himself did everything that was required to fulfill the oath that he's made. There is nothing that any of us need to know beyond that. Now, I'm going to tell you that I love translating Yahshua Isaiah. I want to tell you that I love translating and think about what Dode said in the Mizmor, the Psalms. I love thinking about the prophecies that he has made, particularly those that have yet to occur. Love that stuff. Yeah, love that stuff. The bottom line is, all we really need to know was conveyed in chapter 10 of Observations of Our Time, because it focused on what Yahweh promised to Abraham and to all of us through him. All the rest is just additional facets on this lovely diamond. All of it is just additional colors, additional insights, additional confirmation. The core, everything we need to know is conveyed right there. I would dare say that if anyone were to pick up Observations for Our Time, and I started reading it the other day. You know, I don't quite have as much time for translating. I'm in the final throes of trying to sell the farm here. I don't know if I'm going to get it done. I'm hoping that it happens. I've got a lot of other things that are on my plate, and I'm spending less time translating. I'm doing it like yesterday and today. I did spend a fair amount of time working on the one of the final concluding chapters of Volume 2. But you know, as I do these things, I'm just constantly reminded, particularly as I picked up Observations for Our Time the other day and just started reading from the beginning. And it starts off, I mean, in your face, controversial. It essentially says everything that you have been told is wrong. You know, the opening line is, hate is a virtue.
Yeah,
it's good to hate. God, isn't that the antithesis of what we're being told?
Absolutely.
And it goes through everything about why religion and politics are wrong. And it systematically deconstructs everything that we've been led to believe. Just think of anyone having the audacity to begin a book by saying the antithesis of what is considered to be correct.
Well, think for only one second. The government has its plan, and everything Yahweh said, even on the two tablets mm-hmm. of stone where he wrote, he said he told you what he hates.
Mm-hmm.
If you even start on the second tablet, don't go to the first tablet. He tells you what he hates, and we, our government, as most every government, embraces all of that stuff. They
yep.
think it's fine to cheat. They think it's fine to
yeah.
lie. They think it's fine to steal. It's
yep.
fine to kill.
Right.
It's okay to covet their land. It's okay to covet their oil.
Right.
Who said? Yahweh said yeah. no.
No.
He said, I'll provide everything you need.
Yeah. Trust and rely on me, not government.
So
not government there to...
That's where you should start this. You did, and you should have.
Right. So what I'm basically saying is what Yahweh was saying.
Yeah.
That if you're going to believe man, you have no chance
yeah.
whatsoever to know God. You have to completely deconstruct what you have been led to believe to build a foundation of truth. But my, oh my, it's in your face. I remember reading it. You know, I'm going to tell you, that's really profound. Quite honestly, it's well written, but oh my goodness. In today's world, I can't even believe I wrote that. It's so confrontational. But we don't have the time to play around anymore. There isn't the time to be coy.
Yeah.
The time is
that's
for another
overwhelming feeling that I get nowadays, the more is realizing how short it is. I mean, this is a temporary dwelling.
Yeah, it is.
Our homes, our place
here on earth. I don't care what anybody else thinks. Tell them the truth.
Yeah.
You know, if they can't accept it, too bad. Don't care. And for those that would say, wow, I need to know more, so much better. Now, this is the next thing here. So I have made a promise. I have sworn an oath to you analyze Shabbos. Shabbos as important as any verb in Hebrew, based on the Hebrew word for seven. And you're right. Every promise Yahweh makes is based upon his plan, seven. And seven is comprised of six, the number of man, plus God, who is one, equaling perfection. Everything God conveys is based on that plan. The very universe is based on 6 plus 1, 7. The 7-dimensional, 6-dimensional universe plus Yahweh's 7th dimension is this idea of eternity and perfection. But this says, I have made a promise and a sworn oath prophetically announces Yahweh.
And they have a clue who's talking.
Well, that's not a clue who's talking. But think about that for a moment. It's one of the things that I have really tried to emphasize. I don't know if I've ever made my case to the point that anyone else has, that it resonates with anyone else. I've never gotten any feedback on this. But just as the language Hebrew has no past, present, or future tense, but simply is, prophecy is. It is a prophetic statement when Yahweh speaks about what he did during creation. It's a prophetic statement when Yahweh reveals what he said to Noah and how Noah responded. It is a prophetic statement when Yahweh conveys his entire conversation with Abraham. It's a prophetic statement even though they happened in the past for both Yahweh and for us.
Yeah.
Prophecy isn't just future events. And that's what's so essential about the Dabbatim test to how to know if it's Yahweh speaking, is that to be a person speaking for Yahweh, you not only have to get the future right, you got to get the past right.
Yeah.
And so we should look at prophecy in the past, present, and future. The creation account is prophetic. The story of the flood is prophetic. The story of the covenant is prophetic. It gives you an entirely different way of not only looking at prophecy, understanding Hebrew, but understanding not only who Yahweh is and how he conveys prophecy, but also what we shall become. Once you realize that a statement that Yahweh makes about something he has said in the past can be prophetic, you understand that as a spiritual entity-based being, time is. You can celebrate a moment in the past. You can enjoy moments in the future. You can live in the present. And you can do all of them at the same time.
If you're light.
If you're light. Yeah. There's only one way to become light.
Which offer is.
As a material being. And that is through the covenant. That is the only way.
Yeah.
But as light, and Yahweh being the closest thing to light in terms of, you know, that light is the closest thing to his nature.
Well, I understand.
That we can understand is probably the best way to say it. Light is the closest thing, the most symbolic metaphor for Yahweh's nature in his universe that we can understand. And as light, everything simply is. Now, the fact that it simply is, you know, don't think that for a moment that constrains us to the moment. It doesn't. You know, light is not actually timeless. Hebrew is not actually timeless. Light is time full. Hebrew is time full. Both encompass the entirety of time. And by encompassing the entirety of time, and this is what's really special about Einstein's theory of relativity, which is really a proven fact,
mm-hmm.
is that light and our perceptions of time reveal that we have the opportunity as we transition from energy to matter, another one of Einstein's equations. Who would have known that Einstein would have been so useful in understanding Yahweh's nature? That as we transition from energy to matter and then make the transition from matter to energy, we have the opportunity to experience all time and then also to be in the ordinary flow of time. So we can maneuver back in time and enjoy any moment in time. We can move to the future and enjoy a moment in time. We can witness the entirety of time, or we can relish a spectacle in time. So it's not timeless, it's time full. A very different idea.
You can see the whole parade.
Well, you know, I can see the whole parade. You can participate in any moment of the parade, at any time, in any place.
Well, that's probably why you have the Torah in your heart, or the more advanced Torah with his protector, so you can't mess it up. You could change time, you know, under that kind of concept if you didn't know better. So
if it's the Rose Parade.
There must be a governor on there somewhere that says, okay.
You can, in the Rose Parade, you could be the Grand Marshal of any and all Rose Parades. You could be the guy driving the most exciting float. You can be the spectator in the best possible seat. You can be the commentator that has paid the big bucks to say, well, those are really pretty flowers. How many delphiniums were used on that float? You can be in the blimp above, witnessing the whole thing. You can be somebody pounding the drum as you walk down Colorado Boulevard. In any parade, in every parade, in any position of the parade, as well as being the spectator of the parade, as well as watching all parades. You can even examine the nuances that comprise every flower. As well as saying, I know the guy that created the flower. As well as create your own flowers. So, when he says, prophetically announces Yahweh, and he's speaking of a sworn oath that he has made already to Abraham, and that he by himself will fulfill it, we've been given yet another insight into who Yahweh is and what we will be like because we have been made in his image. Pretty cool.
Yeah.
Now, it says, prophetically announces Yahweh, Nahum, you know, again, this was not spoke, was it? It wasn't Amar, it wasn't Dabar, it was Nahum. And so you really got to think it through. Why did he use Nahum here?
I think
that time, Kirk, is the promise of the covenant. Time is really the promise of the covenant.
Oh, well, I agree, absolutely.
Right? So by Nahum, he's saying,
or being
time.
Not restricted by time. Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. The promises I have made regarding the past, present, and future. It's what this invitation to communicate with me, Kara Amar Naam is all about. All three of these verbs were blended together to tell us that it is the Mikra, where Yahweh speaks to us about what it's like to exist through all time. Kara Amar Naam.
Yeah.
Now, if you've got a different explanation for why God chose three different verbs as opposed to conveying it with the same verb, well, go ahead.
No, no. It's an infinite number. It's sevenfold. Then you got Naam as a form of proclamation. And what's he talking about? Well, he's talking about us becoming light.
Right. Yeah, in fact, I haven't left out the middle verb, which was Shabbat. It's to a verb, which is to promise and to swear an oath. So I have invited and called out. I have said and affirmed. I have made a statement to uphold. And I have made a prophetic announcement, declares what I have said in the past and what I am going to do in the future. Four verbs, all of which shed a little different perspective on the spectacle playing out before our eyes. Prophetically announces Yahweh, which makes it absolutely certain that Yahweh is, in fact, the Malach. Because indeed, and that makes this Malach the illuminated voice of Yahweh. So we're right on both accounts. Because indeed, he Yahon. You know that he is because, verily, truly, surely, verifiably. Yahon is very seldom used, and so when it's used, you got to think about it. It means absolutely for the express reason. Sincerely, deliberately, and actually. And then comes my favorite word, Asher. For the benefit of the relationship. To show the way to an upright and elevated state with a joyful attitude. And thereby to encourage those walking the correct way along the proper and specific path to a prosperous life. You have acted and engaged in accordance with the word. Kirk, we got the fifth one in there.
Yeah.
Kara. Followed by Amar. Followed by Shaba. Followed by Naam. And what's the other word for said? The bar. Five of them. Now, five words for said. You'd have to be absolutely derelict not to consider the nuances of each word and ascertain why each word was used in that specific place. We're invited, and then God spoke to us. And he wanted to reaffirm that he's made a promise to us about the very nature of his word and us surviving throughout all time. Why? For the benefit of the relationship. And all of this was afforded to Abraham for a single reason. You acted and engaged in accordance with the word. You acted and engaged in accordance with the word. Well, let's deal with those two things.
Okay.
Asha is a word that can be simply translated do. Did. You do the word. You did the word. What I have found, though, is that 90% of the time, if you translate Asha as act and engaged, acted upon and engaged upon, that it is a more valid, more insightful, more illuminating definition. To act and engage. Now, it means this says, in the plain sense, Abraham, you did what I asked. You listened to what I said, and you did what I requested. That's what it says. All right? That's what a shaw means. Abraham is with Yahweh today because he did what Yahweh asked. He acted and engaged upon the terms and conditions of the covenant.
Trusted and relied.
Right. So.
And acted accordingly, yes.
So, if you want to be where Abraham is,
I think I'd do the same thing.
Wouldn't you just do the same thing? Do you think that it is possible for God to have given these instructions to Abraham about participation in the covenant and for him to say, because you acted upon my words, you're in this place, and for God to treat you differently and say, Kirk, yeah, you know, I've filled my quota of artists. Kirk, I want to take you, but not Terry. I'm sorry. You know, I've filled my my quota of personnel directors. No.
No.
Yahweh is incapable of contradicting himself or reneging on his promise. He just said, Shaba, I've made an oath. Before that, he says, I'm going to fulfill it by myself. Yahweh is incapable of reneging on a promise. He made these promises to Abraham. Abraham acted upon them, and so should we. And if we act upon them, we will derive the exact same result that Abraham did.
You know, you say something like that, and then immediately flash on Yehudim. I mean, and you go, you know, it's directly to, I know we get it almost as a bounce off because we read it, you know, Begoy and so forth, but. Mm-hmm. He's talking to Abraham and his family, and it's repeated through Yishak and all the way down to Jacob and the 12 tribes. And this is so, I mean, what an offer. I mean, I'm going to put you in this land, and it's going to be your land. I'm going to be there with you, and I'm going to actually, even says, goes on to say, we get to down the road somewhere, you know, that I'm going to grow with you.
Mm-hmm. He does say that.
I mean, we're going to grow together. This is going to
be
great
fun,
man.
Yeah, it's going to be great
fun. And you don't pick up the Torah and read that and just go, I'm in. I'm all in.
Yeah. By using a shah, though, is there any possibility that Paul was right when he said that Abraham was considered righteous because he believed? He had faith?
No.
Is there any nuance, any potential way to construe this verb, asha, as faith or belief?
No.
It's an action word, isn't it?
Absolutely.
This is the very thing that Jacob should his letter be authentic. But this is the very thing that Jacob was trying to convey in that letter. That letter was entirely based on a singular concept.
Mm-hmm.
Faith is useless. Actions are what matter.
Yeah.
Relationships aren't based on faith. They're based on actions. The covenant isn't based on belief. It's based on engaging. Yahweh chose this word in a language he created and conveyed it to us through Moshe, because he wanted us to know that if we want to participate in the covenant, we must act. We must engage. Belief is useless. Faith is useless. And to act and engage, you have to know what you're doing.
Yeah, you got to know where the path is.
I got to know
how to get on the path. You can't get on the path till you meet, you know, until you walk away.
Yeah. This is the test, after all.
Yeah.
This is the test. Well, the way that Abraham passed the test is he acted and engaged in accordance with the word.
Mm-hmm.
That's how we passed the test.
Right.
Now, this next thing, it said that in accordance with the word, eth, which means in relation to, ha, dabar, the word. Ha, dabar makes dabar a noun rather than a verb. Dabar is a verb and it's a noun, depending on how it is described. Cast in accordance with the word. And it's ha, ze, at the end of it. Consistent with these specific statements. Attributable to this account in this narrative as it has been recorded and communicated. Es ha, debar, ha, ze. So, what word did he act upon? What word did he act upon? The words that were conveyed to Abraham and recorded for our benefit by Moshe in the Torah?
Yes.
He didn't need no stinking New Testament, did he?
Are you sure he didn't write this down, too?
That Abraham didn't?
Yeah.
You know,
it seems like I found some clues from time to time, and it sure sounds like...
Well, I think it's possible. And I think Abraham was literate. If Abraham was from Babel, which he was, how is it possible that Yahweh could have spoken Hebrew to him? And the fact of the matter is that the first languages of man outside the garden were conveyed by Nephilim, man, by those who were booted out of the garden, and they spoke Hebrew. And we know that Yahweh created Hebrew. This happens to be from Jackie, because he begins his account in Bereshit by speaking the universe into existence. And his communication is in Hebrew. So Hebrew existed 14 billion years before man existed. Yahweh created the language. The language he used to communicate and that he taught to Adam.
Mm-hmm.
And so when Adam and Chawa left the garden, they spoke Hebrew. And Hebrew became the de facto language outside of the garden, is why Yahweh ultimately confused man's languages so that man wouldn't corrupt Hebrew. Yeah. That's a huge reason for Yahweh, Babel, mixing together different tongues. Because with man's propensity to twist and to confuse, the last thing Yahweh wanted is for man to abuse his language, Hebrew. So if you had man being man, with every language other than Hebrew, that's probably a good thing. But keep in mind that Aramaic, the kissing cousin to Hebrew, it is a derivative of Hebrew. Why? Because that was the language that was spoken at that time. So Abraham absolutely would have understood every word that Yahweh said. Now, of course, Yahweh has the capability that he spoke to me in English and that ain't his language. I understood what he said in English. And so he can use any language to communicate to us. But the very fact is that he chose Hebrew. Hebrew is his language. And the words that Abraham acted upon are the words that we have been reading.
Yeah.
They're the words contained in the 10th and 11th chapter of the first volume of Observations for a Time.
Yeah.
Those are the words. There are no other words, right?
No. That's the... You know, it's like flogging a dead horse. Guys, this is where you find it. This is what it is. And
right.
Spend your time here.
Yeah, in accordance with the word. And by the way, who has just introduced himself? Yahweh. Prophetically announces Yahweh. Because indeed, for the benefit of the relationship, you have acted, engaged in accordance with the word.
And now he's introducing his son. Yes.
Yeah, I was worried
about too. Yeah.
Yeah. And you have not withheld your son, your unique, special, and beloved child. What he's saying is here is the reason that you acting on my words has merit is that I am fulfilling them and enabling them through my son. And by doing what you did, you have prophetically painted this portrait of exactly what I'm going to do. So, the reason that you acting upon my word matters is because I, by myself, am fulfilling this promise through my beloved son. And in this particular case, I know that this naturally points to Yahusha, but it also points to Dod, because Dod's life explains, illuminates how to observe the Torah and how to engage in the covenant. How to be Yahweh's son. just beloved. You're special, unique, and beloved child. That's why it's there. It has all to do with Yishak and nothing to do with Yishak.
Yep.
Yishak is named playful laughter. He's the son that Yahweh gave Abraham and Sarah so that they might appreciate the inheritance of the covenant, know what it's like to be Yahweh, and to enjoy the fellowship of a child, to raise a child, to love a child. That's why Yishak exists. That's why he's important. But this has nothing to do with Yishak other than by presenting Abraham, being willing to sacrifice his own son, we see in Abraham the father who enriches us, who did the same for us, completing and fulfilling the promise.
Yeah. Well, he said it was a prophetic announcement, so that should tie in quite well with Yahusha.
Yeah.
Story to come, sure.
Yeah.
As well.
Therefore, key, verily, this is reliable, dependable. I will kneel down in love to lift you up, enriching and blessing you. Barak, Barak, Atah. What does it mean if a verb is repeated?
Great emphasis.
Right. Take it to the next level.
Yeah.
Expand this to a very significant degree. It's like the words much, very, totally, overwhelmingly. And in English, if you would place before a verb, those kinds of things, you know, very fast, extraordinarily fast, amazingly fast, uncalculably fast. Well, that's what Barak Barak is. When he says Barak Barak, you just can't say, I will bless you. You can say, I will bless you to an unimaginable extent, or you can dig into the fundamental meaning of Barak, and you can say, I will kneel down in love to lift you up, enriching and blessing you. That gets some of the flavor of the exponential nature of a verb like Barak being repeated.
You know, knowing that the promise is for after Bukurim, to be Shabua, to be enriched and empowered, it's hard for me to look at Barak anymore as just blessing and lifting you up. Even that doesn't seem to be enough, because we know what he's doing, because we're going through the Moed Mikros to get to that point where we are empowered and enriched. So I notice that you use enrich. I would add empowered too.
Yeah.
Because it all is just... This is like Barak squared.
Yeah, and what's interesting is that it's followed by Rabbah squared. So Barak, Barak, I will invoke divine favor upon you and will commend you. I vow to meet you in the most beneficial way and enjoy my meetings with you. I will adore you, causing you to prosper. I will speak of your extraordinary contribution to reconciliation. It was written in the Peel. Infinitive, absolute, peel perfect. Abraham is the beneficiary of the intensity of Yahweh's blessing and is empowered by it on an ongoing basis throughout time. And, in addition to that, I will, to an extraordinary degree, magnify and multiply, and I will abundantly increase the importance and magnitude of your offspring.
Rabba,
Rabba. Again, repeated.
Mm-hmm.
I will rear and help grow. And to an exceedingly great degree, I will empower, enrich, enlarge, and enhance Hifl infinitive, absolute, Hifl imperfect. Yahweh is committing to continually facilitating Abraham's participation and to cause Abraham to be like him. Ongoing basis. of your offspring, Eth Zerah Atah. Is he talking about the direct descendants of Abraham, or is he talking about the beneficiaries of the covenant, the children of the covenant?
The beneficiaries of the covenant, of course.
Yeah, I think some of both, however.
I think they're going to increase, and they're going to be powerful and that sort of thing, but they're also, and there's tons of them that are going to be part of his offspring that are going to be horrible and confused and attack, you know.
Since he is talking about the Yishak here, you did not spare your son, your most beloved son. Therefore, the rearing and the empowering is not of Ishmael. It is only of those that come by way of Yishak. Yishak understood the Torah. He understood the covenant. He understood who Yahweh was and did as Yahweh asked. Yishak is part of the covenant. So you're right.
Mm-hmm.
And being a, even though Yishak is a direct descendant of Abraham, and Jacob was a direct descendant of Yishak, and the 12 tribes are direct descendants of Jacob, and they comprise Yisrael, including Yehuda. The fact of the matter is that in this context, it's not just the children of Yisrael, it's the children of the covenant. Because it's Abraham and Yishak that are being addressed. Your offspring. And what did he say? Similar to, consistent with, and comparable to the light of the stars. By saying he didn't say, I'm going to turn them into light. He didn't say, I'm going to make them like light. He didn't say they're going to be equivalent to light. He said similar to. Similar to.
Mm-hmm.
Yahweh is similar to light. We will be similar to light. The stars are just a perfect example of what light is. You know, it's the closest star, our sun, that is the source of light for our planet. Even at night when it reflects off the moon. And it's the light of the stars that fill the night sky. Yahweh has already told Abraham, when he took him to the light of the stars, and Abraham, you know, this part of Abraham said, I don't get it. You know, I don't have a kid. There's nobody for me to give an inheritance to. What in the world is an inheritance going to do for me? You know, I'm 90 years old, and I have no heir. What are you talking about? An inheritance. And Yahweh didn't show him, the nursery. He didn't show him a crib. He showed him the light of the stars. And now he's returning to that and saying, your offspring are going to be light, similar to the light of stars. How is Yahweh coming back?
As light or bright.
Right, as a constellation.
Very illuminated, let's put it that way.
Right, yeah, constellation of stars. That's what he says right here. Your offspring shall be similar to the light of stars of the spiritual realm. Isn't that amazing? We're going to be light. We're going to be akin to light. That's the way we're going to be empowered, enriched, enlarged, and enhanced of the spiritual realm. But this is really kind of neat. He says, but also like the coarse sand, which is upon the lips of the sea. When I first read this, I said, why did he just stop with light? Why did he also say, but also like the coarse sand that is by the lips of the sea? I didn't really get it until this very moment, so if you don't know the answer to this, don't feel bad. I didn't get it until this very moment. When I translated this a bunch of times and long ago, and I didn't get it until this reading. That's why I kind of like doing this show. I learned so much by rereading God's Word. Okay, he says, I'm going to transform you into the light of the stars. Now, being light is really cool. You can go anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
You can see everything at the same time. But if you're only light, if you're only the E side of E equals MC squared, if you don't ever do the transition from energy to matter, and that transition is beautifully compared by the size and the magnitude of a star compared to a speck of sand. It does a marvelous job of comparing the difference between energy and matter. Isn't E equals MC squared means that energy and matter are the same thing? It's just that matter is such a tiny speck and must be multiplied by the speed of light times the speed of light to be equal to energy. So that comparison is between the light of the stars and a speck of sand. Because with E equals MC squared and our future, we're not only going to be light, which is profound and it opens up eternity, but eternity, because light is such in time that it does not flow, it cannot be measured. We need to occasionally do this transition, and this ability to do this transition between energy and matter is what's going to make eternity so fun. This ability to do, you know, I've projected this so many times, and I think this is a confirmation that I may have been right, that in eternity, we're not only going to be a spiritual light-based being, but because of E equals MC squared, we are going to be able to make this transition just as Yosha did from energy to matter when it matters. When we want to celebrate the Mikra in a timeline, when we want to celebrate the Shabbat on a timeline in eternity, we have to transition into matter. Otherwise, time doesn't flow. We can't eat unless we transition into matter. We can't sing unless we transition into matter. We can't enjoy some of the great thrills of life, which is to go hike on a mountain path and enjoy nature and to smell the fresh air and to feel the breeze through our hair and experience the coolness of the creek as it runs through our toes. We can't feel the sand wrap around our feet as we walk on the beach and hear the waves crash on the shore unless we have the ability to be both like the stars and like the sand. God is telling us what he's offering us. And it's both. Some people might say, I'm going to go for the spiritual thing. I want to hang with you. I'm going to spend all my time in heaven. Not me.
No, I would assume we were going to play and do some stuff and have some kind of physical
ability. Not me. I want to go places. I want to do stuff.
Yeah.
I want to feel stuff. I want to taste stuff. You know, imagine being able to eat the most wonderful thing in the world and not gain weight. Pretty cool, huh?
Yeah, you know,
to walk up by the greatest mountain trail you can ever imagine, and the pack isn't a burden.
Mm.
The air is never thin. You know.
Yeah.
To be able to run as fast as you can imagine, to be able to be there with the animals, and commune with them.
Oh.
And I love animals.
Well, I love riding horses and stuff. It's great fun.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
They're back as well.
That is what I think he's saying. And now, the looks of the sea. Now, kafa is translated typically shore, but based on the Hebrew word for mouth, word, speech, language.
Yeah.
The edge of something, the boundary of something, the shoreline of something. So, the coarse sand, this particulate, upon the mouth, the words, the speech, the language. The very edge and boundary, the shorelines. Of his word, the contours of his word. Now, the sea, you know, this speaks of metaphorically of Gentiles, and thank God it does, because, well, we're Gentiles, most of us here. Well, we're not all Gentiles. A lot of Yahudim and a lot of Israelites in our family and in our company, and the more the better. But, you know, there's a lot of goyim here. And many of the goyim are here because of the lips of the sea, the lips of Father Goyim, as they have tried, striven to convey Yahweh's word. And that matters. And, you know, here it is, a couple of goyim, and we're the ones talking about this transition from the light of the stars to the sands.
Well, it's an odd thing if you think about it in the world today or any time. I mean, where we spent, we started an hour and a half ago reviewing something we had already talked about, but now into more degree, and it's about Abraham's story.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Abraham's story. And by the way,
that ain't the most popular thing on TV right now.
Right. Yeah, the lips of the sea. Guess who were... Yes, it was a goyim.
Yeah.
Abraham, right?
Yeah.
Right.
That's true. Yeah, yes, of course. And Yitzhak, too.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I probably should make an apology for covering old ground as opposed to moving forward. But
well, there was a whole bunch of stuff you came up with today. That was fascinating. This is really cool.
And
I've got pretty decent notes, and you still got, you know, and I still write things down in the columns. So
that's the joy of doing it.
Shoot.
Yeah.
This is very...
Of expanding of what we know. That's the joy of doing it. Yeah.
Listen, you could have stopped it. Here's the five terms and conditions and made a pamphlet.
Yeah,
that would be no fun at all.
Wouldn't
this is... This is deep. You know, this is amazing, the depth of it. Probably if we come back to it next year, we'll find something else.
Yeah, and it's thrilling.
Absolutely guaranteed.
It's exciting. It's reassuring. But it's not just deep. It's not just exciting. It's not just reassuring. The essence of life itself.
Yeah.
The purpose of creation. There's nothing more important. Not all of the armies that ever marched, not all of the kings who ever reigned, not all of the words that ever spoken, not all of the treasures ever found, even approximate the value of these words. This is life's greatest treasure. I'll ask you a question, Kurt, something that just dawned on me this week. What is life's greatest adventure?
Walking with Yahweh, to me, now I can't really say that.
Yeah. Specifically, generally, relationships.
Yeah, oh yes.
Life's greatest adventures are relationships. Nothing more rewarding, nothing more enjoyable. In fact, all the grand adventures that we can go on are only valuable if we can share our discoveries with someone we care about, if we're accompanied by someone we love. And so life's greatest adventure, relationships. And the greatest relationship is the covenant. The covenant is with Yahweh. So you went directly to the ultimate answer.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there's a perspective there.
Family.
That is useful, which is that life's greatest adventure is developing a loving, mutually beneficial relationship. And it's only then that all of the other adventures are worthwhile.
Well, I'll tell you, I've had a rough week this week with people. I won't go into it. It's been a rough, rough week. Strange, bizarre people nowadays. And I was getting where I can't stand people. They're driving me nuts. They're crazy. And we were sitting here, Tara and I were sitting here thinking, you know, won't it be nice when we're all there with them and we're all on the same page and we're free from these bonds of time and space and all the rottenness goes away and we can go on all these great adventures? Absolutely.
Yeah. But, you know, Kirk, I'm going to share a couple things with you. First of all, you're a very fortunate man. Your wife is part of the covenant.
Yes.
You're a very fortunate man. I mean, that's There's fewer. That is the exception rather than the rule. That puts you in an extraordinarily beneficial place. Second of all, as we converse, as we share during the week in all of our emails, as we talk on this program, as so many of the covenant members talk among themselves, the contrast between that and the futility of other relationships and the true expansive joy of covenant relationships, isn't that just a marvelous contrast?
Mm-hmm.
In other words, if you weren't exposed to twiddly-dee and twiddly-dum, would you really have the full appreciation of how magnificent and honorable Yahweh is?
No, of course not.
No, sometimes the contrast between Yahweh and government, Yahweh and religion, Yahweh and human institutions is helpful. I like that concept. I've had a week where I have, in fact, several weeks now, where I've seen the worst in humanity. But I also have seen some of the best. And I really have an appreciation of the blend of these two. I think it's true. I've just finished this particular statement. Genesis 22:17. It just concludes with, "In addition, your offspring shall inherit and impoverish the thinking of his enemies." Now, all that is encapsulated by that, I probably don't fully appreciate, but let me just throw a few things off. First of all, it says, in addition, your offspring, Zerah, which would be the children of the covenant, shall inherit. Well, that's what the covenant is all about. It's an inheritance. Yahweh began it as an inheritance, and he's continuing to speak of it as an inheritance. Do you think Yahweh has any interest in, or should we have any interest in inheriting what man has? No, you can't say what man is offering, because man ain't offering diddly squat. But, we began by saying, would you trade all the wealth, all the power of collective humanity and every institution for this relationship with Yahweh, for the truth that we've come to know?
Truly not.
There is nothing that man has that I'm interested in inheriting. Although, man has sought to control the earth and to control the animals within it, the life in it,
mm-hmm.
and to control people's thinking. And, I'd like to take all that away from them. I'd like to inherit an earth that is free of them, where animals thrive, where beauty excels, where truth prevails. I can see inheriting that. And I also recognize that through Ishmael, mankind was impoverished. And of course, this is about Sha'ar, which is about thinking. Your offspring shall inherit thinking. Thinking. The calculations and reasoning. But it's also the monetary system and cities of his enemies. Oeb, who? Now, Oeb is very seldom used as the definition of enemies. Very seldom, very seldom. So we have to think about it. We have to think. It means foes, opposition, those who are hostile.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that means that, all of the power, all of the influence, all of the wealth of the Roman Catholic Church, for example, they're going to lose it all.
Yeah.
We will be given what we haven't even sought, and they will lose it. Governments seek to take money from the people and redistribute some of it only to enhance and entrench their power.
Sure.
And they build large armies to solidify their control.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to lose it all. And everything that they sought to obtain be given to us.
Yeah.
Not ultimately is fair. Our enemies are religion and government. Those things are going to be taken from them and given to us. No.
Well, you have an example of that when it came out of Egypt, you know, they paid them off.
That's right.
Years ago, and then,
right.
And the, and if you want to figure out who the enemy is, I was thinking this week there is Shaul number one, and he's got government and military. And Shaul number two, he's got religion. Everything Yahweh hates.
Right.
And those two guys.
And those became his son, inherited the universe.
Mm-hmm.
In between them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're going to build him a house for him right next to his.
Yeah, and he said that the children of Israel came out of Mitzrayim, out of Egypt. They were given the wealth of Egypt. The Egyptians gave them everything. Okay, here, take it. It's yours. I guess you earned it. I'll give it to you.
They did.
Yeah, they did.
It was very fair.
Right. You know, and the Egyptians no longer control their dependence. The Philistines no longer exist. Imperial Rome no longer exists. The Roman Catholic Church is soon to be for naught. Everything they sought to build, everything they sought to own, to influence, be taken from them and given to us. The earth that they tread upon and sought to control, given to us as a gift.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I originally just thought of it as a throwaway line. Okay, yeah. Well, all right, I'm, you know, big deal. Inheriting the universe. What in the world do I want with my share of some of this, right? Well, I thought about it. You know, for 1,000 years, this is going to be a pretty special place.
Yeah.
This is Yahweh's very special place. A lot of wonderful things to see here and to enjoy here. And ultimately, Yahweh has to be fair. This is a choice between relationship and religion. This is a choice between trusting in Yah and relying on government. And so, for Yah to be fair, there has to be a loss by those who made the right choice and a gain by the a loss by those who made the wrong choice and a gain by those who chose correctly. That's why this line has to be there.
He's consistent, isn't he?
Yeah, he is. He tells the whole story.
Amazing.
You don't want to be Yahweh's adversary. It is not good to be religious or political or militaristic. They're really, really bad ideas. Because ultimately, everything you've sought to gain is going to be taken away from you and given to those that you came to despise. Lovely. That's why the only people shown bowing down before Yahweh are those that are being judged.
Those being judged, of course. Wow.
All right, my friend, this was really fun.
It was. It was.
It was
done,
for
me,
and it's fun for our listeners, because Yahweh.
I have a word for the day. I got off the phone right before we came on with Dr. Jeff. He is calling a new term for the Philistines. He calls them the Fakistinians.
The Fakistinians. I love it. The Fakistinians, what he's, of course, referring to for those who haven't been ongoing listeners, is there's no such thing as a Philistine. There once was, but the last of the Philistines were destroyed by Assyria, murdered by the Assyrians, 2,500 years ago. They don't exist as a people. And so no one can be a Palestinian today except to lie about who they are. Fakistinians. Perfect.
Old boys, kids, and dads, I'm telling you.
Yeah. Hey, even if really it's what's swell today is the Trumpster went over and talked to Rocket Man, and he has declared that North Korea is no longer a nuclear threat. No, isn't that just no agreement?
Well,
yeah, no agreement. But the Trumpster has ordained it. I just loved it. Following his news conference with Fat Hair Fat Boy, mm-hmm. he says, "Listen, 6 months from now, you know, we might find out that I'm wrong, but he says, I'll never admit it, and I'll take it anyway." It was like reality TV that had nothing real about it. Oh God! No wonder God hates government. It's just despicable.
What a country. What a country.
What a country. What a country. You know, there's a bunch of people that were once part of our audience here that just love the Trumpster.
Yeah.
I think that he's actually doing the right thing is telling the truth. Now, that's not to say that everything the Trumpster does is bad. I think some of his economic policies are better than his predecessors. And some of his approach to fair play are better than his predecessors. But overall, the guy is just a joke.
Yeah.
So,
well, if you want a joke, you have to come to California.
Oh, yeah.
We are.
Oh, yeah. You know, I guess there's an initiative, though, to make three Californias.
Yeah, I don't think the government wants to do that, because then you can gerrymander it and you might get some of those votes. So.
No, of course
not.
There's far more power and big than there is in small. So the people will be told, the liberals that follow along will be told, no, don't vote for that. Yeah,
but you know, show how stupid our thinking is out here. We had an El Nino at the end of it totally ended the drought.
Right.
And then last year, this winter, it didn't rain a lot, but it snowed a ton. I mean, the Folsom Lake is huge. I mean, it's up to the brim. And it's still coming down because of the mountains. It comes down the American River.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've got tons of water. Now they're predicting another El Nino for this winter. I mean, the response from that from our governor is to make you conserve.
They want to control. Yeah.
Well, they want to control, but also, you know, then you can fine everybody that uses what they actually need.
Yes.
So they can use an arbitrary tax. It's just not a...
Yeah.
Oh, God. What a place. What a place.
What a place. All right, my friend. Same time next week?
Yes, sir. Enjoy the business. Thank you so much.
A wonderful week, and this was really fun doing this together. Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Appreciate
See you later. Shalom, shalom.
Okay. Shalom, shalom. Good night.
Good night.